Hello, you're listening to FlixWise Canada. It's like regular FlixWise, only much, much colder. And I'm Martin Kessler. Joining me today is Dave Eves, who's a film enthusiast, I guess. Is that okay?
Sure. I'll stick with that. I don't
filmmaker,
have
film person.
I don't have any sort of like super popular blog. I updated it like once, like maybe last year, and that was it. So I'll consider myself a Twitter person.
Because yeah, I always enjoy engaging with you on Twitter, usually saying ridiculous things.
Of course.
But you're somebody who's wit and enthusiasm for film I greatly admire. So
thank you very much
to have you on to discuss filmmaker I'm very interested in, Mikhail Kalatozov.
Yes.
And I feel like he's a filmmaker who doesn't come up that often in conversations, and when he does, is
what conversations
really
are you having that's not all about what is it, Kalatozov? I want to add an M in there. It's almost like Kalamazoo.
Kalatozov. I don't know. Do you find that like
talk about Kalatozov?
No. They go from like if you talk about even Soviet cinema, a lot of the times it goes like Eisenstein, Dovzhenko, and then straight up to Tarkovsky. Like nothing happened in between. But I sort of feel like he's the in between.
Yes.
You know, if you want to figure out what the bridge is between like the Odessa Steppes and like how do you go from that to Ivan's childhood? I think like he's sort of the key filmmaker in that. Maybe. But I guess we're mostly going to discuss his three most famous films.
The three that are actually available in the United States.
The three that are actually available, which are The Cranes Are Flying, Letter Never Sent, and Soy Cuba, I Am Cuba. So how were you introduced to these films?
Back in film school, actually. My film school, which was Drexel University, we didn't really talk about a lot of Russian films. I was never forced to watch the Odessa Steppe sequence ad nauseum. as far as I remember, if I did, I blocked it out. But we watched Soy Cuba in I can't remember if it was a European cinema class or a non-Western cinema class. I feel like it would make sense for the European, but also if you want to say like Soviet cinema is vastly different from Western ideals, it could have been in that non-Western class. I don't remember, but the funny story about watching Soy Cuba, the professors led off the class by saying, if you don't like this film, then you shouldn't be here. And that's like the last thing you should tell a 19-year-old, because it just breeds like, well, I'm not going to like this then, and I'm going to prove you wrong. And I actually fell asleep.
Oh, no.
Another terrible thing about film school, the screening room were the most uncomfortable chairs in the world. The second the lights went down, it was the most comfortable place I was ever in. And that college sleep pattern of getting like 3 hours of sleep and then waking up to go to class, there were times that I fell asleep during movies that I ended up really liking when I watched them later. And one of those movies that I ended up really liking later was Soy Cuba.
Right. Oh my god, I know that feeling so well. I used to have some classes at 9 in the morning.
Oh no.
So by the time you show up, you're already tired. And a really, really great Romanian teacher, Teresa Barta, and she would show us, like, come and see at 9 in the morning. And it's sort of like the right balance between, like, I'm completely traumatized and also really sleepy. So it left a strange impression. But
and now every time I feel tired, I feel horrified.
Soy Cuba was one I also saw in film school. I think it was like a class on third cinema, which it's kind of a weird pick because it's not really third cinema. I think like the fact that it is sort of a non-Cuban filmmaker, but I guess we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah, we will.
But the other two, I think those are the ones that are available from Criterion.
Yes, in some capacity.
And they're both frustratingly bare bones releases, I found. Especially like Letter Never Sent.
There's nothing on that disc.
There's nothing about it. Like there's...
I almost... Like, one, it's the movie that I need the most answers for. Because there's two... Like, if you guys... If people listening have not seen it, there's a gigantic forest fire that takes up the
bulk
of the film.
How did they do it? I have no idea.
There's two options. They did it all in a studio, and they did it amazingly, or they set the forest on fire and just said, actors, just be careful.
It sort of looks like maybe it's a little bit of both. Like, there's times where some shots look like maybe there's like a device where you can put flames coming up right in front of the lens.
Yes.
That makes it look like, you know, maybe if you have a little bit of that in the foreground and then some controlled burning in the background. But it feels so immersive. It's like unbelievable even today how you would even accomplish that.
That still does not explain the one long take where Sergei is like diving under the water to get around the burning branches to like save their food. That's a long take.
It looks so unsafe.
I'm wondering if they're just like, well,
life is cheap.
Life is cheap. We got to refilm it again. We lost another Sergei. You know it's bad when your film credits have an in memoriam section.
Letter Never Sent, it also feels like he's sort of building on certain visuals from The Cranes Are Flying, because there's also sort of like there's a very brief sequence where she's running through the bombed out building and there's fire there, so it almost feels like, oh, okay, now I can take this and run with it. And also like the way you shoot snow and the way the environment changes, like it seems like a filmmaker who's very interested in modulations of an environment. Like, here it is, and then in the second act we're gonna set it on fire, and then the third act it's gonna be covered in snow, so you're sort of familiar with it, but it keeps
changing.
Yeah,
I would say, like, if you needed to sum up Kalitozov's career, it's like, in terms of at least for the three films that I've seen, I literally tried to find other ones that you even sent me, and I'm starting to watch them. I'm like, wait a second, I don't speak Russian. But in those three films, it's almost like, hey, we did this idea here. Let's take it and run with it for the next one. That's like everything. It's like, how far can we push this? How far can we push the envelope in what we're doing cinematically? And I think that's something that's so admirable in his work.
I think so too. Like, he's constantly, even just the lens size, like, they seem to get wider with every progressive film. By the time you get to Soku, it's like, you know, there obviously weren't GoPros, but, you know, if you were filming today, you get the feeling that it would just all be shot on GoPros.
Yeah.
It's that almost fisheye sized lens where I guess part of that's to keep as much in focus as possible. You have the deep depth of field because there's so much camera movement.
Like, oh, yeah.
If you were the focus puller, you would just have a stroke. Also, like, I think because he's somebody who seems very interested in how people fit into these environments, and he's very interested in the environments, when you're using those wide-angle lenses, like, you can have a close-up shot and also see way into the distance, or also see, like, buildings around them. It sort of doesn't close off a person's face from the environment. And sometimes, though, to get the close-up shots, I noticed, especially it's so cool, but, like, there's shots where the camera's so close to people's faces, you see the shadow of the camera operator on them, or like it's like bumping into leaves. I don't even think of that as a mistake. It's just like you're sort of conscious of the fact that the camera's in these situations. It almost makes it feel more real. Like, you just dropped a camera operator off in the middle of this
jungle
chaos, you know. And it sort of doesn't feel that choreographed, even though I'm sure it must be very carefully choreographed to achieve that.
It does feel almost like it's improv with the camera in terms of some of the movements. But obviously, since, I mean, with Soy Cuba especially, they're like handing from one cameraman to the other, putting on a rope, swinging it down in a street, putting it underwater, all this amazing stuff. But I think what's really interesting with Soy Cuba, and I think one of the reasons why maybe they went with wider angle lenses, that seems like a rinky-dink production almost at times, even though it was not. I think because of the fact that you have these Soviet filmmakers that are suddenly on foreign soil, they probably were given less money than they're used to working with. And it almost seems like they had to make compromises. And I might be completely off. It just has somewhat more of a, like, you go from like the super studio-ishness of like Cranes Are Flying. Then a few years down the road, you have Soy Cuba, which very much feels like it's on location. They're trying to make do with what they have. And in doing so, they're being just as cinematic, but almost more inventive in how they're coming about it.
I mean, there's times where it does sort of brush up against documentary. It almost feels like, you know, I'm not sure, like you said, what kind of crew he had, but I'm sure he couldn't bring over huge armies of people to work on the production. So I don't know if he had what was available with the Cuban film whoever was trained, or and like a mixture of both. I don't know what the situation was, you know, because it does seem like maybe, okay, I have my camera operator, I have my whoever, you know, very small crew. I'm going to approach this almost like a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I can stage stuff. It's not a documentary. It is scripted, but I'll shoot it almost as if it is one.
It's funny because IMDb lists it as drama/documentary.
Right, or like maybe travelogue. It almost feels like that at times.
Yeah, I can see that,
because I mean there is a plot or several plots, four plots.
Yeah. It's an anthology film. Everyone's favorite.
Right. So, someday I want to do an episode on anthology films. They're so.
Oh my goodness, I'm used to anthology films being really terrible horror movies. So
right.
Anytime it's a great work of cinematic art, it's always like, wait a second, my what are we doing here? Correct me if I'm wrong here. I think this is actually one thing that I took away from when we watched in film school, that he filmed it with special like infrared either lenses or film stock, so that all of the green of the leaves would be this
glowing
white. So it literally feels... Because I'm sure he's like, I've never been, but if he's in Russian City, he's probably not used to seeing that much green. And suddenly you're in this lush tropical environment, which is not constantly cold and snowing. And you got to do something to make it pop. And I think kind of that outsider perspective of wanting to portray it in a way that really pops makes it very vivid and interesting to look at in the way he's portraying that nature.
That outsider perspective, I think that's consistent throughout the film. Like, he's so interested in just everything he looks at. Like, you know, he's shooting the slum and it's just as interesting as the jungle. And then he's shooting the nightclub and it's just as interesting as anything else.
Yeah.
He's, the way people dance when the camera's moving back and forth with the twirling dancers. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can tell he's fascinated with this place and the people in it. I think, like, more so than... those kind of like broad pro communist plots, like I don't know if he was maybe just like paying lip service to that, like if that's just what you needed to do to get that kind of a film made, you know. But he seems like somebody who's maybe not that interested in that, you know, in the sort of overt pro communist politics.
I can see that. It's tough for me to say, because one, I mean, I've seen Tarkovsky, I've seen Eisenstein, mm-hmm. and I've seen Kala Tozov in terms of Russian film. And
right.
I'm in America where we're just like, hey, boo communism until until recent politics happened. Now we're just like, maybe the Russians aren't that bad. It's because I don't really know what the true values are. The only way I can really kind of perceive them is from movies, really. And... if you were to ask me, and you did ask me this question in a sense, like, hey, is this guy paying lip service or not? And it's just like, wait a second, maybe he was. I don't know. I think that Soy Cuba definitely has a kind of undertone of being like, hey, we need you to make a propaganda film for us.
Right.
Yeah. And he's just like, okay, I'll use this propaganda film to tell a story about people, but I still got to throw in some things here in order to get my paycheck or whatever they would have given him. I don't understand how Soviet Russian society works.
Right. Some of the films, like, I was trying to read if there was maybe some kind of, like, more veiled political subtext. Like, Letter Never Sent, I'm like, okay, is the fire the World War II? And then is the snow Stalin after? And then, like, him being rescued at the end, it's, like, surviving Stalinism. You know, you make it to the thaw. I don't know.
It fits. I think it's funny with Letter Never Sent, because that was the second one I watched. That was the first Kala Tozov film that I watched fully without ever falling asleep during it. And that one's great. That one actually might be my favorite. But it struck me as being very foreign in the sense that I can just imagine this is like an American film, especially made by like someone like Michael Bay. They would be like, oh, I can't believe the government sent out here to get them diamonds and now we're in this forest fire. And there'd be like an evil like CIA guy that's like trying to kill them and steal the diamonds for themselves. Like that's how I would perceive it as American. But in that film, it's just like, we're doing this for our country. We're going to survive this forest fire for our country. We can do this. I don't know. It doesn't seem very anti-Soviet Union. At least it's not anti-Soviet Union enough that it was able to get past any sort of censors.
I don't think of it as a political film exactly.
No, I agree with that.
Maybe I think of it as an environmental film. That's
yeah,
more than anything else. And Cranes Are Flying, again, like the way it deals with the war, it's sort of not typical, but at the same time, it doesn't really feel like anti.
It's almost like it treats it like, oh, this one had to happen, but let's not do it again.
Right. You know, and on one hand, it feels a little bit anti-war, but on the other, it's sort of balancing like, oh, civilians had to do their part too, and it doesn't really undermine the contributions of people in the war.
No, it doesn't. And I also appreciate the fact that it's a war film where you're like on the front for like two scenes. Mm-hmm. It's mostly showing like the struggles of the people back home. And even though it's kind of the war is the backdrop for this love triangle that's going on. Like that's the main story going on there. And if I wasn't already a fan of this filmmaker, I probably would have been like, ah, love triangle war. This doesn't sound that interesting. Ugh. Then you watch it. It's like, oh my God, this is amazing. It's just the way that they're going about doing it. It's that makes that film incredible.
And you can see, like, I think Cranes Are Flying was the one that won. I forget if it was the Palme d'Or.
I think it won Venice.
It won a few, like, top awards. But you can see, like, why that was kind of the gold standard for the next generation of self-serious Russian art filmmakers. You know, like Tarkovsky doing Ivan's Childhood or Alexei German doing Trials on the Road. Like, you can kind of see those early films by them. Like, they want to do Cranes Are Flying. Like, that's what they're striving for. You think, like, Tarkovsky, all those camera movements in Ivan's Childhood where, like, he hasn't quite slowed everything down yet.
No.
It looks a lot like The Cranes Are Flying.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, the shots where, like, they take the books out of the hole in the ground at the end and the camera kind of lifts up. Like, that feels very Kalatozov to me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And German and Tarkovsky are both filmmakers who, you know, developed this long take aesthetic and kind of took it in their own directions until it, you know, became sort of unrecognizable when you put it up against Kalatozov stuff. But it feels like he kind of established that sort of long take language that really, I think, was like in contrast to the Eisensteinian montage, maybe.
I think he's using the long take in place of editing, because there's camera movements. It's almost like it's doing the editing in camera.
Right, exactly.
There are times where he's literally like, we need to go here, because it's moving through space. It's not just, and like, again, like, look at Tarkovsky's The Sacrifice. The Sacrifice, where the long takes, the biggest long take in that is the end with the house being on fire. That's almost an entirely lockdown shot. It's letting the action play out in front of you. There's no sense of editing there. But then you look at the shot in The Cranes Are Flying, where she's kind of moving through the crowd, trying to get to, trying to find Boris before he leaves. And we're going in, we're weaving out through things. So it's like, we have to get from beat to beat to beat. And in that, you get the rhythm, you get the flow. And that's, on one hand, like, if you're an inexperienced filmmaker trying that, that's dangerous, because if you don't get the beats right, suddenly your entire movie is weird. Right.
I mean, even like, you could compare shots in the Soykuba to the like Odessa Sep sequence, where you have like people marching and you have those crowds, and he's kind of flipping the camera one way then the other, so the lines go diagonal one way, diagonal the other within a single shot, so you get the effect of that, like, montage angles, cut to angles.
Yeah.
You know, like, it has sort of a similar effect. It's just, like you said, done without any edits. I mean, as a... doing the long takes, like, as a filmmaker, like you said, it's always a little bit risky, but it's also like a great feeling when, okay, we just, that's 5 minutes of the film done. It's in the can. Like, you don't have to worry. Once you get it, you get it. Yeah.
Not to talk about our own work, but there was one movie that I was making back in college where my cinematographer, I wanted to have it kind of like as a fake a long shot, basically, but have a lot of intercutting between things to kind of give it a longer flowing feel that was different from the rest of the movie. And my cinematographer wanted to do it in all in one take. And I knew in my head, like, this isn't going to work because the actual timing of the things that people need to do don't line up. And, like, let's try it. And you find out very quickly, like, wait a second, this is not going to work the way we think it is because people don't move this way. Cinema's a lie. You're editing creates this lie of time and space, and just to do in any way, shape, fashion, or form a long shot and make it work, especially with more than just one person, is a miracle in my book.
It's true. But earlier you mentioned the love triangle, which I thought was sort of interesting, and like you didn't get a chance to see it, but I sort of pitched First Echelon to you as like, hey, it's Soviet Days of Heaven.
I was so excited to watch that. That's the one I was, like, wait a second here. And I was like scrolling through it, like, maybe the subtitles come in later. Maybe I was like, oh, this looks great.
But like a couple of his films have these sort of love triangles that like seem to sort of give way to some grander environmental destruction, like Cranes Are Flying, there's, you know, it turns into the war story, or Letter Never Sent. It's like there's this kind of subtle love triangle, or maybe not so subtle, because like that's the only thing you have going outside of Hey, Let's Find Diamonds.
I would say it's not that subtle.
Yeah, no, it's not that subtle, but like it's not like it's not quite melodrama either.
No.
By the time the fire comes in, you sort of forget about it. But like,
well, it's almost as if their passion ignited the fire.
Sure, like it makes me think a little bit of like Days of Heaven, where you have the you know, like, hey, there's this love triangle going on, and then like, oh wait, it's on fire and everything's brought down, the end of paradise. I don't know what the relationship is exactly, but it seems like there is one. Or maybe not, I don't know. Well, like, do you think there are any themes that link the three movies, or are they just mostly linked aesthetically, stylistically? Like, is it just a place where you can experiment with style, or?
I think there's like a humanistic kind of bridge between them all. It's kind of like the triumph of humanity over adverse conditions, and there is a connection between natural things going on. I would say, if I were to just look at Cranes Are Flying and Letter Never Sent, like there's two pivotal scenes that take place during scenes of natural, not so much natural chaos, but like of chaos. Like in Cranes, there's the scene where it's implied that Veronica is raped by Boris's cousin, and that's happening during like the bombing. Like, so it's this, right. There's this chaos happening. There's this, I don't want to say natural, but there's something going on. And that's one of the, it's such a well-shot sequence. And that's all this quick cutting that kind of is similar to what they're doing later, but with long takes. So it's this emotion from chaos, sort of, and humans existing in this chaotic state. And I think that there's at least one scene of that in each. Like, so you have scenes, yep, again, Forest Fire in Letter Never Sent, or of like looking through trying to find what's his face that went missing in like the smoked out ruins of the fire, that seems very kind of humanistic, like trying to triumph over this thing that's happened. Or let's say, again, this isn't exactly natural, but it's the triumph of humanity over like when the rebel guy in Soy Cuba is walking through the hoses to try to deter him.
Yeah.
That's just humanity existing in this state of chaos.
And those are some of the most poignant moments in all three films, I think, anyway.
I agree.
I'm curious, how did you find the portrayal of the Americans in Soy Cuba? Is it like pretty?
Oh, that was hilarious.
Too naive.
No, it's
although
it's,
sometimes it's wonderful. I swear you can find those people for real. Like
that's the terrible thing. It's just like, oh, look at how they're. Oh, they're not exactly wrong. It's great because their accents are terrible. Oh boy, I want a piece of that tasty morsel.
Wouldn't it be great to be like the token straw man American? Like, how amazing would that be as a role?
That would be,
anything goes if you have enough dough.
Yeah. it's funny. It's like, oh, that's what they think of us. They're not wrong exactly, but it's not everyone.
While I was at the Beijing Film Academy, that one of the films screened was Cranes Are Flying. Or maybe it was just an excerpt, because I remember a lot of the times it would just be like half an hour of a film.
Isn't that always the worst?
That's the worst.
It's great in terms of learning, but later it's like, but I wanted to watch the whole thing.
Well, like, oh my god, there was this one film I watched while I was there, and I had no idea what it was. It was like all shot in sepia tones, and it was about Genghis Khan, and I'm like, this is amazing. This is the one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. I wanted to see the whole film, and I wasn't sure what the title was, and I wasn't sure who made it. So for years after, I was like Google searching like Genghis Khan movie, Genghis Khan movie sepia, Genghis Khan movie 90s, and then like it wasn't until going through Alexei German's body of work that I stumbled back onto it, and I realized it was The Fall of Otrar, which he wrote and produced with his wife. That film's amazing. That film's so good, but you can't just watch half hour of it. It's not right.
We had one class on directing, and our teacher just showed us the first 5 minutes of like 10 films. It was painful. It was a great lesson, but like, no, that was the best one.
Oh, it's true. Yeah. I don't know. But at the same time, it can be such a time suck if you need to
watch the whole. Like, we're going to watch the first 5 minutes of this film, followed by the preceding 90 minutes.
I mean, what I was kind of grateful for prepping for this episode is that Letter Never Sent and Cranes Are Flying are pretty short and fast.
Yes. Compared to Soy Cuba.
Well, yeah, compared to Soy Cuba. And, well, even Soy Cuba, like, it's not so awful to prepare for because, like, you can kind of break it up.
Yeah.
It was enjoyable to prepare for, but just time-wise.
Yes. Oh, for me anymore, it's just like, I don't have 2.5 hours.
No, I know. It's horrible.
I got 90 minutes max some days.
Oh, my God. It's getting to the point now where I'm like, okay, that's what I'm going to be watching at 2 p.m. in 3 weeks. You know, it's turned into that.
No, I'm right there with you. My movie watching time is generally for at least the movies that are more interesting to me are after my fiance has fallen asleep on the couch, and it's like, okay, let's see. I think I can be awake for 2 more hours. Let's watch this, and then I'm like, oh, an hour in, I'm done.
Oh my god! And then like you know, you finally get free time, and you know, the girlfriend's like, you know, let's go and see that Blumhouse horror movie.
Hey, Get Out was great.
Get Out was great. I was thinking of Lights Out.
That was so disappointing.
There we go.
That was so disappointing. The only Alexei Garman film I've seen is Hard to Be a God, and I loved that one.
Right. You know what? It's like one of those films. The first time I saw it, I was like, oh, wow, that was really different. And then like I watched it again. I'm like, oh, I kind of love this. And then I watched it again. I'm like, no, I love this.
I have the Arrow Blu-ray that I'm just waiting for 3 hours to watch it again. Because the first time it was literally like being on a different planet.
It is. It's like one of maybe only a handful of films that like I truly deeply give a shit about from the last couple of years.
Philadelphia does not have a great revival film scene.
Right.
The one thing that we had recently that was remotely exciting was that Cries and Whispers played it on 35 at the local incredibly snobby art house film.
That is exciting.
Theater. and I had just watched it the other week on Blu-ray, and I was like, ugh. It's a Thursday night. I'm annoyed at myself for not going, but at the same time, that night I just did not feel like going to the movies.
No, I get that. Especially like some films, you sort of almost feel like obligated if they're playing to go and see it.
Exactly.
Like, oh, I'm a film person, I guess I should see it. And you know, retrospective of this filmmaker, mm-hmm. They're important. I don't always feel like
no.
It. I don't know. Like,
and to be honest, had it been playing at a different theater, I would have been a lot more inclined to go.
Right.
Completely off topic. There is a. An area of the Philadelphia suburbs known as the Main Line. And it is the Philadelphia Story. You've seen the Cary Grant movie?
Yeah, yeah.
That is set in the Main Line. So that is the super, it's one of the richest, wealthiest suburbs in America.
Right.
And it's this sense of entitlement. I live just outside of it. But the closest art house theater that caters to wealthy, old people that like... really want to see a nice picture, like, oh, well, The Woman in Gold is playing. I'm glad they finally are making good movies again. That's the type of art house theater this is.
There's more than one, but there's like one theater I always know it's going to be bad for that, where it's like, like, I know for sure if I go, I'm going to be the youngest person there by like 30 years at least.
Mm-hmm.
I know people always talk about like teenagers talking through movies, but old people are the worst
because they'll
talk at like full volume about things that like aren't related to the film, or else they'll like just reiterate things that you've just seen on the film. It's really annoying.
So it was his daughter the whole time. You're yes. Watching Tony Erdman.
Oh my god. Oh,
but I'm glad the snobby film types don't listen to this show.
I'm glad they do. And one thing I thought was like sort of like unexpected was I'd seen the big three, the Cranes Are Flying, Letter Never Sent, I'm Cuba, and then I'd seen The Red Tent, which was Kolesov's last film, and it's about rescuing these Italian Arctic explorers, and Sean Connery's in it. It's sort of like a weird international co-production, and like it's sort of him redoing some of the stuff from Letter Never Sent, where you have like shots of people as the camera like flies outward, revealing the enormity of the environment around them, and it's all these like great shots of ice, and that was, it's all in color, and it's really striking use of color. And I just assumed like, oh, that must be his only color film, because the previous three were in black and white. But then it's like, I found it, it's like his like fifth color film.
Yeah, first when I was when I was scrubbing through the first echelon, I was amazed to see that that was in color,
and like not just in color, it's like gorgeous color.
Yeah,
and I like, I don't know what it is about the film stock that they were using of that era. I don't know if they were using like Agfa film or like what it is, but like it has such a different quality than like Technicolor American films, or even like, you know, when you watch 1950s color Japanese films, like it also has like a totally different look.
Very much so.
You know, there's just something about the way it renders skin tones and the way it kind of, like, you know, some film stocks over time, some fade to red, some fade to green, like kind of has this like greenish tint that can be quite beautiful in its own way. It's,
especially if you're used to watching them like on old, like, no, unrestored DVD or like a VHS, you feel like, oh, they all look like that. And then you see it restored and it's like, wait, where'd the thing go that I like?
I don't know if like, did you notice if Filmstruck like has any of the other films?
I saw Soy Cuba on there, actually. I saw Soy Cuba and The Cranes Are Flying on Filmstruck.
Okay. Because, I don't know, I wish more people could see these.
Yeah.
I wish I could see more of these.
Yeah, I think that the biggest shame is that there's not more of these available. But I feel as though, just in general, that that's kind of the case for Soviet films outside of Tarkovsky or Eisenstein, I guess, at least in the U.S., because I know that there's rights issues with region coding in different countries and yada, yada, yada. But I think this is a filmmaker that that desperately deserves more and better attention.
All right. Well, thank you, Dave, for coming on to talk about Mikhail Kolesov.
Thank you for having me. This has been a delightful chat.
It was a nice chat.
of arboreal cinema on this arboreal podcast.
Where can folks find you?
I'm on
internet and in real life.
You can find me on Twitter at Cinema versus Dave, Cinema vs Dave. I live in Philadelphia. Don't find me, please. I mean, unless you really want to.
I was joking. I didn't. I didn't mean that.
No. I'm curious now. It's almost like a challenge. If people track me down, I will be horrified.
Oh no. And if folks want to follow me, I'm at Movie Kessler on Twitter. The show's Twitter is at FlixWise. The website is FlixWise.com. And there's also a Facebook group where you can like us, and I don't know. Do you go to iTunes to rate and review people? If you do that to the show, that would be nice. Thank you. bye.